Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley, and I am your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. I was just looking at reflecting back, and for 11 years now on Progressive Radio Network, Love, Lust, and Laughter has brought you shows to help with sexual empowerment, sexual self-empowerment. And really, it's so true, a lot of sexual misery stems from mistaken beliefs. We need more sex education. Joining me is Dr. Hernando Chavez, here to help navigate two common male problems. PE, that's premature ejaculation, and ED, erectile dysfunction. And Dr. Hernando he's a licensed marriage and family therapist in California, and he's also a doctor of through the Institute of Sexology. Dr. Hernando, welcome to the program. I'm so glad you're here. I've known you for quite a few years now. We met when I used to live in Los Angeles. But tell our listening audience, first of all, how and why you became a sex therapist.
Well, hi, Dr. Diana. Thank you for having me on today. And I love your show, and I really appreciate you having me on. Why I became a sex therapist was really kind of by accident. I was actually a child therapist to begin with in my therapy career. And it was difficult. It was, there was a lot of burnout I was experiencing. I was working for an agency where they had a lot of cases. They were giving you, 30, 35 sort of cases. And a lot of the difficulties with the children was actually around the parents, but they weren't really willing to address their the parenting changes and some of the things needed for the house to become better for the children. So I was going to leave therapy, but, lo and behold, I discovered that human sexuality and sex therapy was a thing. So I went back to school, got my doctorate, and the rest was history. I love what we do. I love the passion in the field. Learning about sex is one of the great joys of my life.
Yeah, learning about sex. I've talked about this before on this program, but a small study was done some years ago, wondering if sex therapists had better sex than the rest of us. And according to this study and the people that they interviewed, the answer is yes, because we have sex with less anxiety. And you and I are going to talk about performance anxiety in regards especially to PE and ED. But sex therapists tend to have more confidence because we have more knowledge. And knowledge is empowering. I opened the show by saying, a lot of sexual misery stems from mistaken beliefs. So we have more confidence. Would you not agree with that? Yes.
I would agree. And I think that it's in part because most sex therapists have done the work to truly look at some of the core issues in their life that have either inhibited their own sort of sexual freedom and authenticity, as well as looked at some of the areas that produce shame and guilt in their life that may be adjacent or attached to their sexual selves or sexual expression.
Very, very well expressed. And of course, the shame and the guilt contributes to the very common problems, premature ejaculation and erectile dysfunction. But the performance anxiety, if there's shame and guilt, that feeds into performance anxiety hugely. Would you not agree? And maybe you even have a case study example of this.
Well, I think that, performance anxiety for each person is going to be individually specific, but it's often rooted in what we experience in the social constructs around us. Many times it's environmentally reinforced. So it could be within our family structures. It could be within our religious institutions. It could be within our peer groups. And you'll find that when you do a history for a person, let's say in a sex therapy assessment, you'll find that oftentimes there are rigid expectations, there are pressures, there are stereotypes that people have been exposed to, and then they start attributing and internalizing for themselves that then become, fuel for their anxiety. One may be, for example, many people may have a religious background, And there's nothing wrong with religion. However, there are times when some of the dogma or some of the messages sent through some spiritualities and some through some religions can make us feel bad about our sexual selves, can put pressure on ourselves to not live the life of a sinner, but live the life of a person who's, you know, sort of going to get into heaven. And if we do certain things like premarital sex or oral sex or masturbation, that these might be attributed to sins and going to hell. And that can be one version of a person's struggle with anxiety that might create stress and internal fear and the worry that oftentimes, you know, becomes part of our internalized shame.
The internalized shame. And some of this has fueled the so-called sex addiction industry. And Michael Kesselman and I spoke about that on my last show, and in regard to the Atlanta murders of the Asian masseuses. And we sex therapists believe that there's no such thing as sexual addiction. And but many, many people that come out of highly religious backgrounds and do have this internalized shame that you talk about. And actually the shooter in Atlanta blamed it on his sexual addiction. Do you ever talk about sexual addiction and with your clients, or do you ever have people coming to you like, fix the addiction? I know Marty Klein has said, I don't fix addiction. Sometimes it's the wife coming in. I don't believe in sexual addiction, and the wife will come in and says, my husband has a disease. He's philandering.
Yeah, and you know, I would imagine your guest, your previous guest, Dr. Kesselman, also talked about this as well. But with this concept of sex addiction, it's also something that's socially constructed. That when we look at the research, especially some of the more modern research by someone like Josh Grubbs or some of his colleagues, they're looking at the internal experience of moral incongruency as the root of people identifying as sex addicts, meaning if it conflicts with the morals that they have developed within their internal self, which sometimes can be associated with spiritualities or religions, but it also can be associated with our family conservative values, for example, that moral incongruency is what drives people to define themselves as being a sex addict. And many times you'll find in people's histories that they may ascribe this label to themselves when they're actually not doing things that are any different than what the rest of society is doing. They may masturbate once or twice per month. They may watch pornography just a few times here and there, you know, once or twice per month as well. Yet they feel so bad about that that they have internalized that this is something wrong, something shameful, and even something addictive. Whereas others, people may say, well, this is perfectly fine for my life. I feel really good about, you know, masturbating, or I'm comfortable with using porn. And so there is a strong sort of evidence to suggest the morality of the individual is at root when it comes to identifying as a sex addict. And I don't believe that sex addiction exists either. I do believe that there are folks that have struggles with their sexual expression and behaviors, and it may be rooted more in either a compulsory experience, or it may be rooted in something called out-of-control sexual behaviors, which is, I think, the more modern way that people are now addressing people who struggle with managing their sexual expression. The OCSB model, which was developed by Doug Braun Harvey and Michael Vigorito out of San Diego, it really has been, I think, the gold standard for us working with people who are struggling with their sexual behaviors.
Yes, the internal experience and the out of control, the compulsive people, impulsive compulsive. I can't come up with an easy segue from sexual addiction to. I want to talk a little bit about penis size, because this really plagues men, and then we'll get into premature ejaculation and erectile dysfunction. You know, I want to tie in porn to this because most men in porn are huge, of course, but in the 1970s, there was a male porn star, his stage name, Richard Pacheco, and I've actually gotten to know him a little bit. Brian and I, my husband and I, paid him a visit several years ago in Berkeley. His name is Howie Gordon, and he wrote a, a wonderful book about his experiences in pornography in the golden age of so-called golden age. Richard Pacheco, he's a really fun guy, really nice, and he was known as Mr. Average. So the story is that, and by the way, he's been on this program, but not for like maybe 7 years. So he auditioned on a lark, and being average size, he was surprised that he kept getting cast. But in those days, many producers allowed women to choose their partners, and they often chose Pacheco. You know why? His penis didn't hurt them. You know, a huge penis can bang into the cervix, and it can cause women pain, and particularly with rear entry, the doggy intercourse. And Pacheco joked that he had the smallest dick to ever hit the big time. And one more porn reference is also from that era, but even went beyond it, porn star Ron Jeremy. And he was famous for his huge penis. And he said, "More women have gotten off on my tongue than my cock." And, of course, that's usually true. Men need to be reminded, even if they have an average penis, which is erect, is about 5.5 inches to 6 inches erect. They need to remind themselves that, well, to eat more pussy. Because that's where the way that lots of women get off. If you want to talk a little bit about penis size, and some men's, some men are pretty obsessed with it.
Absolutely. You know, as we describe performance anxiety as more of an umbrella term that can be so many different things, penis size is one of the anxieties that people, penis owners experience, oftentimes because of the messages we have internalized from the outside world that have sort of sent this message that bigger is better. And we see that in a lot of different areas of life, both sexually and non-sexually. But as you're bringing up, larger doesn't necessarily mean more comfortable or more pleasurable. It may be that it is aesthetically desired because of those, you know, stereotypes and those myths. But when you get to the root of asking people about, you know, pleasure, most people will say that, you know, pleasure for, let's say, a person with a vagina isn't going to be internal penetration, but it's going to be what you're describing, which is outer sort of pleasure, clitoral pleasure, labial pleasure, you know, more sort of oral pleasure that can create maybe more of a suction or a wetness around the clitoris as opposed to internal thrusting. And so when we start really getting, I think, more in tune with what pleasure is for each individual, for their body, I think we start realizing that penis size is a little bit less centric to pleasure than we originally had thought or assumed. Now, that doesn't mean that people still don't have anxiety around it. Many people's body images are going to be expressed in different ways. It could be our breasts. It could be our weight. It could be our penis size. And many times you'll find penis owners really minimizing their experience of the import of their of the impact of the other sort of experiences of sex, like outer course, oral sex, mutual masturbation and touch, and really maximizing and magnifying those, that emphasis on their penis. And a lot of people also, when they look at their penis, they also see it as smaller than it really is. And so there's also our internal judgments and internal sort of anxieties that get magnified with that. And for a lot of folks, sometimes helping them accept both that their penis is a part of sexual pleasure as opposed to the main centric focal point helps with them seeing that there's a lot of options and opportunities for pleasure within our bodies.
So many opportunities, so many. And you said a lot of guys aren't really able to see their penises as they are. They're looking down. And if they've developed a belly, then they're even going to have it more hidden. But most heterosexual men don't see erect penises. And in, like in a gym situation, you're going to see flaccid penises typically. And some men are more growers, not showers. So the smaller flaccid penis typically gets bigger when it's erect than a larger flaccid penis. It grows. I'm not expressing this very well. Tell me, you're a man. Tell me how to express this better.
Yeah, I think you're talking about the, you know, the showers and growers, and also our if our flaccid penis may be smaller or larger, even with an erection, we typically sort of all wind up in the same similar sort of average erect state. So you mm-hmm. can't really tell erection how long a person is based on their flaccid size penis. And with the anxiety component as well, that's one of the things that I'll work on with people, which is getting more comfortable with their penis, both flaccid and erect, with their partner's present when it's non-sexual. Because a lot of the anxiety is attached to sort of having to perform in those moments, and we can face some of that and desensitize some of that when we allow our penis to be a part of our everyday experience. And what I mean by that is I'll have a person, once we've done some therapy around, you know, their penis size or their anxieties, if they're partnered, I'll have them do something like a cuddling exercise where the intention is not to get hard and penetrate, but the intention is to just be present with our flaccid self. And I may have the partner be held while their partner maybe touches their flaccid penis and just holds it. And they just sort of cuddle and they breathe together. Maybe they kiss, but the intention is not about leading into intercourse or penetration or sex or erection, but simply getting comfortable with us being present. And that experience can be done while watching TV or a movie. It can be done while having some foreplay. But for a lot of people, becoming vulnerable and facing some of that anxiety and then getting the supportive messages from partners can really be helpful in us beginning to manage some of that, the intensity of that performance anxiety, especially when it's around body image.
Oh, Dr. Hernando, you know, that's a brilliant exercise to give. And I'm going to borrow from that, because a cuddling with the flaccid penis and breathing together and feeling vulnerable. And also, I think it helps a guy to know that he can sometimes, in the flaccid situation when he's relaxed around it, well, my goodness, here comes an erection. Mm-hmm. He'll get excited when he's more relaxed and less anxious. But the exercise that you're describing is really, it should be pure and unto itself, just enjoying the flaccid state. But don't you agree, sometimes... Yeah. The man is surprised when he gets an erection.
Absolutely. I mean, because that comfort that's developed over time reduces anxiety, and then sometimes that erection spontaneously sort of arises because we've reduced the anxiety. I think a lot of people don't realize that our anxiety can inhibit the functioning in the brain that sends messages for us to send blood to the penis or blood to the genitals. So if there is anxiety in the brain, it can inhibit things like arousal. So that could be lubrication or erection. Anxiety in the brain can inhibit, you know, experiences like orgasm. It can essentially deter or even block the brain from experiencing some of those milestones within the sexual response cycle, because anxiety is powerful and it inhibits our sexual processes to occur. So we've got to look at addressing the roots and the core of our anxiety so that we can hopefully experience more pleasure, more sensation, and a little more freedom within our sexual experiences.
Yes. Anxiety in the brain. It's powerful, and it of course we're talking also about too much cortisol and adrenaline, and that can impact every single part of our body. The too much stress, of course, can undermine erections by. It slows the production of hormones, and this is the brain doing it, right, including testosterone, the master male hormone, and it impedes blood flow to the penis. And so what I suggest to my clients is to reduce stress is to spend at least 20 to 30 minutes a day doing something you personally enjoy, whether it's watching your favorite comedian or participating in a hobby such as woodworking or going for a walk with your dog. And while you're doing this, you're breathing and you're relaxing. And most important, you're staying in the moment. Mm-hmm. This mindfulness that has to kind of... Mindfulness and being in the moment is so important in our sexual relationship, I think.
Yeah, that's been, I think, the future of sex therapy, and most postmodern sex therapy, I think, is rooted in mindfulness and the use of relaxation techniques to help our mind and body gain that anxiety reduction. And, you know, I've had clients who've come to me who have had such high anxiety levels that their anxiety will actually inhibit the pills that they're taking that are meant to sort of help with their erection. For example, our Viagras or our Cialis or Staxi.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And one of the things we'll do is practice mindfulness touch, mindfulness masturbation. And even before a sexual experience, I'll encourage them to do a few things, like to prepare themselves for sexual experiences, to take that pill, but then to take a hot shower, to stretch, to do, you know, 20 minutes of meditation before we're about to become intimate, and then encourage them to not rush the process, but to involve themselves in massage or sort of touch and sort of discuss foreplay in terms of creating anxiety-reduced experiences that are pleasurable. And typically we find that we work towards managing those mental thoughts, those distracting thoughts, some of the performance anxiety components that plague our brains, so that they can experience sort of the comfort of not having a lot of anxiety in those sexual experiences. And it takes time, but many times that mindfulness process really helps with allowing our bodies, our brains, and even some of the medications that we've been prescribed to support our, you know, our desires when it comes to being sexual.
We're focusing on men in this program, but women, and the women that I've worked with over the 35 years I've been doing this work, often are not practicing mindfulness when they're being sexual. They've got a mental checklist, and they're checking off all those things because they don't really want to be there. Either they're experiencing pain, or they're a whole bunch of other, they don't like their partner, they don't like how he smells or something. But the mindfulness is difficult for some women because women have bigger corpus callosum, that connecting tissue between the right and left hemispheres. So probably that was developed because if a woman is being sexual and she has a baby, she has to be able to hear the baby cry, so go to the left hemisphere of her brain. So it's particularly hard for women, but when I get women to do what you're talking, and men to do what you're talking about, to slow down and to maybe see those extraneous thoughts going out of your brain, male or female, like on a conveyor belt, just going out. And with the mindfulness, you can also take a Zen approach. And if you see those, distracting, the monkey mind, that's what it's called, the monkey mind, the distracting right. Little monkeys who are dancing on the branches in your mind and being silly and trying to distract you, quiet the monkey mind and then come back to center. Do you use some of the Zen approaches too?
I do, and I really help and encourage people to try to address those anxieties and a lot of that mental noise in their own ways that feels right for them. And I think each person responds differently to whether it's visualization, whether it's developing your own sort of coaching or mantras that you can say to yourself. But I do find that when people construct their own version of mindfulness when they're feeling distraction, it becomes like a powerful tool in the moment. For example, I'll teach people to breathe, and I'll teach people to create sort of sensation and focus on those areas of sensation. And then they'll maybe develop their own statement or phrase to help them remind themselves when they start veering or deviating away from that. Like, let's say they start thinking about their penis size or thinking about they're going to come too quickly. Maybe they'll develop sort of like a mantra where they'll say, take three deep breaths, get back into the breath, get back into the sensation. And maybe that's what they use to kind of gently bring them back to that path of mindfulness. And I think there's a misconception about mindfulness too as well, that some people think, well, does that mean that all sex has to be really slow or really mindful and sort of emotional and romantic? And I think you can also have mindful rough sex. You can have mindful sex that can vary depending on sort of the being present in the here and now with when it comes to the sexual experience, as opposed to being in a different space of, let's say, spectatoring, for example. And spectatoring is a a phenomenon where people are sort of having a little bit of an out-of-body experience where they're sort of watching and almost directing the experiences that are having with sex as opposed to really being a part of it. I think we want to be mindful actors as opposed to distant directors that are watching, that are judging, that are preparing for the next stage or step or position. And I think that takes us away from being present in that moment. And I think we can develop mindfulness on a spectrum of behaviors, from the slow and romantic to maybe even the rougher and sort of the faster.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think it's important. Sometimes men in particular view sexual activity as an Olympic event or a competitive sport, and they need to remind themselves there are no records to be set. Sex is about passion and tenderness and concern for your partner. So slow down, be in the moment, do these things, it'll make a difference.
And I think also, too, the messages we're getting in society also have, you know, let's say we talked a bit about premature ejaculation, PE, a moment ago.
And we need to talk about that a little bit more, too. So, but finish your thought.
Well, you know, sometimes the messages we're sent is that longer is better. But and then we also have messages sent with the porn we watch and sort of the discourse that we have in society that lasting longer is better. And what we find, too, is that most people's sexual experiences are not as long as you see on video, that a video may have a 40-minute sex scene. And that's actually quite uncommon for most people having sex. You know, some of the research will point out from a heterosexual perspective that intercourse typically is about 2 to 7 minutes for most people, for the majority of folks. But you may see that editing or those scenes much, much longer. And so we kind of emulate what we see, and that also can produce pressure for people as well. I think we have to look at porn as a fantasy, as something that is meant to be sexually exciting, but also it's not meant to be sex education. It's meant to be more to fuel some of our arousals and fantasies, but we have to be mindful of separating those two things.
And so many men have trouble doing that. They need to see pornography, as you said so eloquently, but again, as more entertainment. It's not educational. Men should be doing everything porn is not doing. I mean, they should be, like spending more time with massage and more time. Well, I've noticed that pornography, though, in the last few years does spend more time with oral pleasuring for the woman, cunnilingus. And, you know, that all started with my good friend. Now she died 5 years ago of ovarian cancer, but Candida Royale, she was the first one on the scene after performing as an adult actress. She was the first, she's really pioneered the whole business of erotic films for couples to watch, as you know. And she started her company Femme in 1984. So she really was a pioneer, the first one to really focus in on female pleasure and couples. And it wasn't the usual male pornography. It was female explicit movies that really did focus on female pleasure. And a lot of guys need to lose some of their mistaken beliefs around their sexuality. And right?
I think it could be very valuable for us to seek out the media that also reinforces what we're trying to learn. You know, if we are seeking out sort of male-centric, penis-centric, intercourse-centric, orgasm-centric porn, then that's what the messages we're going to be exposed to and internalizing, and therefore it would likely come out into our own sexual play and our own sexual scripts. But what if we changed it up and reached out and found maybe feminist porn or female-directed porn or female-written sort of porn? Would that then, like you mentioned, Candida Royale, who's one of the pioneers of that genre, would that then help us see more of the realities of maybe what pleasure that can be experienced with people who are, you know, filming porn? Can that be something that we can sort of watch and emulate and understand that when we have more of an authentic expression of sexual pleasure as opposed to what is scripted and we're being paid to express, which may be a little bit different than what we experience in our own lives as a porn actor, I think we might find that there may be a more authentic experience of modeling when it comes to watching porn. And I think that it could be valuable for us to venture outside of maybe that box.
Yes. I want to give an example of, to go back to Candida Royale Candace. In the late 80s, and this is before I met her in person, I met her in person at a Quad S conference in San Diego in 1988. But I, in the 80s, I was co-leading two women's sexuality groups with Dr. Maria Flaherty. And they all these women had had trauma, and they were having trouble with orgasms. And I remember using one of Candace's films, I think it was Nine Lives, and the actress was a cute blonde girl with short hair, and I think her name was Gina. She was clearly having real orgasms. And later when I met Candace, I asked her about her. She said, yes, she was, and that she also hired real couples to get the whole thing more authentic. And I know we're veering away from the male, but that's okay. Dr. Flaherty and I actually showed some of that movie, Nine Lives, to our women's groups because the actress was showing what fun sex could be if you had a lot of orgasms and you just were having so much pleasure, and about her lover pleasuring her. So this was the late 80s. So when I saw Candace at this conference in San Diego, I introduced myself and I said, I told her about showing her one of her movies to our women's sex groups. And we got acquainted. And at that time, my husband and I were also watching a lot of her films in the privacy of our homes. So this is the late 80s. And then Candace was just, she was really wonderful in terms of showing female pleasure. And most women have more orgasms and are more comfortable with their male lovers when they really know each other, and there's more familiarity, so there's more relaxation and the ability to let go. But I've been going on about Candace, and I do that. I go off on tangents because that's how I do. But let's talk really specifically about premature ejaculation, because it is one of the most common forms of sexual dysfunction in men. And the last statistic I read, and maybe you can confirm or deny this, Hernando, is that it affects more than 30% of the male population, and it's also consistent across all age groups, but it's more common among younger men, actually. And so, I mean, I recommend a lot of self-help methods and squeeze technique and timed withdrawals and partner exercises and all that. But I really want to hear what you do with your PE guys. Mm-hmm. You've already talked about some of it. You help them to reduce their anxiety. But tell us a little bit more about specifically the PE exercises that you might suggest.
Sure. And you know, to reiterate what you just brought up, you're right on about that 30%. So typically it's around 30 to a third of men, mm-hmm. and it is across the age groups. So it's something that people experience early on in their life, and they consistently experience it throughout their lives if they don't get help or work on sort of some of that experience. That, you know, early ejaculation is something that oftentimes has a mind-body component, and there's an interaction effect that our worries, stresses, anxieties can oftentimes accelerate our orgasmic functioning, or the orgasm gap, we sometimes call. And there are some mental techniques, some mind techniques that we can utilize around breath work, mindfulness, anxiety reduction, even things like sensate focus, where we learn to use visualization as a way to get comfortable with the sensory experience of pleasure. Because for a lot of early ejaculators, it could be the mental anxiety, but could also be the heightened sensory experience that can be part of that sort of acceleration of their orgasm. So you can do a combination of both mind, emotional, and also behavioral techniques The mindfulness is more rooted in anxiety reduction and mental work. The behavioral pieces you brought up a moment ago around the squeeze technique, I'll typically mm-hmm. encourage the start-stop technique, which is about very similar. And essentially what that is that you encourage somebody to first do this on their own, masturbating, where they're going to masturbate up until the point of reaching near orgasm. So we call it the point of no return, when you're just about to experience orgasm and ejaculation. And then I encourage them to do a squeeze, which is a Kegel exercise. So I want them to squeeze and cease stimulation. I want them to go from, let's say, that 9.5, which is right about 10 being that orgasm, and they're right knocking on the door. I want them to let their body go down to about a 6 or a 5. And that means your body will maybe get a little bit more flaccid or semi-erect, but we're just teaching our body to get close to that orgasmic experience, get comfortable with that sensation, and then allow ourselves a bit of a break. And it's typically 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds. And then once they're at that place where the sensation is reduced down to about a 5 on a scale of 0 to 10, I have them masturbate again. And they'll do this mm-hmm. 3 or 4 times. We call them peaking exercises. And it's a wonderful way to teach the body to get comfortable with heightened sensory experiences that are near orgasm. And it also stretches out our orgasm gap. So we have a longer plateau, which is a longer sort of time period for us to between the start of the stimulation and also reaching orgasm. For a lot of people, both the combination of the mental and also the behavioral, which is this peaking exercise, can really be helpful in people expanding sort of the amount of time that they experience pleasure and you know, sort of delaying orgasm a bit. But for a lot of folks, you know, there are other methods as well. Some people will use some desensitization, you know, creams or sprays, which I encourage yes. people to use very sparingly and also yes, not yes. Not rely on them. Some people will go the medication route because there are some medications that can delay orgasm. I typically encourage people not to go that route, but mm-hmm. unless it's like the last resort. And also, too, there may be some physiological or brain-oriented issues that might be related to PE, so it's really important for us to get checked out by a qualified sexual medicine urologist to rule out any potential physical issue, you know, anything related to the brain, a seizure disorder, some type of experience that maybe is outside of the realm of psychotherapy.
Yes, that's so important. I've been doing this for years, of course, and the first thing is to get checked for a man or for a woman. And we've already discussed that some men just need help coping with anxiety, and others having unrealistic expectations. But there can be medical issues involved, hormone imbalance such as hyperthyroidism, mm-hmm. and maybe yeah. Infection or inflammation of the prostate gland. And genetic factors, or even erectile dysfunction, and in that case, it's probably that the guy with ED, he fears losing his erection, and so he ejaculates prematurely. Diabetes can be another thing that happens that shows up when the man is getting checked out medically.
Absolutely. So there yes. can be so many factors to address, and I think that's why it's so valuable to find a qualified sex therapist that can help you maybe address some of these different areas and issues, you know, in a way that you can systematically start to rule out maybe some possibilities. And we also, you know, there may be other factors that we haven't necessarily gone into, which is it lifelong? Is it acquired? And if it's acquired, what's at the root of how we acquired some of these sexual concerns? Could it be associated with a breakup or with a relationship that is producing a lot of anxiety within ourselves, or even that work stress of, you know, maybe a new job that all of a sudden created sort of this intense, anxious experience within life that is also manifesting in the bedroom? There's a lot of places to look at, you know, to try to uncover maybe what are the origins and the core, what is at the core of our struggle.
I'm so glad you mentioned this, Dr. Hernando, lifelong or acquired, and yes, that is a question that I ask, and I know other sex therapists ask mm-hmm. in that first session, because let's face it, I think the pandemic and all of the anxiety that has occurred has filtered into our sex lives, mm-hmm. and some men have more anxiety, of course, with the pandemic, and then it and then it manifests with premature ejaculation, or so it's acquired, or erectile dysfunction.
Yeah. I mean, right before our show, I just got off the phone with a potential new client, a lesbian couple, and the female was sharing that about a year ago, they started noticing that the frequency of their sex was really diminishing, and they've been noticing a lot of disconnect and lack of frequency of sex. They've started fighting and arguing, and so, you know, my initial question was, well, what happened a year ago? And, of course, about a year ago is when the pandemic hit. So my guess is we need to look at what is the mental health sort of changes that have occurred a year ago, whether it's depression or anxiety or something else, that have maybe been sort of at the core that have created sort of this ripple effect into our sex lives. And many times people don't realize that the timeline of our struggles when it comes to our health and well-being, we don't always see the core of what's happening. We sometimes are focusing on the external expression, like the orgasm or the frequency and the number of times we're having sex, but there are things behind the curtain that we have to sometimes dig deep to discover. You know, that old metaphor of peeling back the layer of the onions to find what is at the core.
Absolutely, and that's why psychotherapy and work with a sex therapist can help not only improve sexual skills but increase self-confidence and improve self-esteem. And all of these things can ease PE and also ED. Maybe we ought to, before we run out of time, we still have some, but let's talk about erectile dysfunction. Men are so identified. Tell me if I'm right about this. Men are often identified with their penis, and if it's not working, they're often just devastated. It seems to ruin their sex life from their point of view. Can you talk about the personal, not your personal, but your experience, because I doubt if you have erectile dysfunction. Right, Dr. Hernando? I wouldn't.
Well,
you're a handsome guy, of course, and you're young, and you know about these things, and you, every time I see you at a conference, you have a lovely lady on your arm.
Well, you know, to normalize it, I have experienced that as well, too. I mean, sometimes maybe I drank too much, and all of a sudden my sensitivity or my physiological functioning has changed because of, let's say, alcohol. And there can be a lot of experiences. So I think we should normalize that throughout the life process, you know, erection can vary. And it can be also varying based on our mental health and experiences in life. Breakups or job loss, things like that can also affect our sexual functioning. So we have to, I think, normalize that these things can happen in different times of our life. But there is truth to the research that over time, as we age, you know, penis owners will develop more propensity for the physiological roots and causes of erectile concerns. So the older we get, it's potentially the more challenging it is for us to experience something like erection because of things like hypertension or some other physiological, cardiovascular, or components that might be changing as we age. So we have to normalize that. That's partly our experience. And you did bring up something really important, which is how rooted many penis owners are in their identity around their erection. That what I've witnessed with a lot of men in particular is their job and their penis seem to be an enormous part of their identity. That if they lose their job, that can be crushing in terms of sort of their confidence and their sort of their individual identity. And the same with the erection. If an erection becomes inconsistent or they develop something like ED. And I think we have to start working towards seeing the person as a whole rather than simply a person who's producing a paycheck or the confidence that we build with our resume building and also with our erection. I think we have to work towards feeling more confidence within ourselves as to who we are as people, as relationship, as, you know, fathers and husbands and sons and, you know, emotional sort of supports. And, you know, I think that there's just so much more to individuals that oftentimes is not being witnessed by the person because of that intense focus on these certain identity factors that they hold so sacred and so profound.
Yes, and let's also talk about the female partner of this man. I think the partner the impact that the partner cannot be overemphasized. There are a lot of women whose middle-aged husbands become impotent, and they believe the women believe it's all their fault. And one policeman told his wife, the wife said, if I were Marilyn Monroe, even a dead man would get an erection. And of course, just the opposite is true. Any middle-aged man with a potency fears would be confronted with a Marilyn Monroe type would probably turn to jelly. But middle-aged wives continue to be the most convenient scapegoat. I've had clients like this where the wife is blamed for this. It was a little more in the past because I think now we have a little more information. But the wife ends up being scapegoated, and this comes from a man who is not very confident typically, and is confused and is upset and is anxious, right?
Yeah. It's unfortunate because I think it's human nature for us to sometimes attribute responsibility to ourselves, maybe even personalize, that we will take it upon ourselves to make it our fault because that's sort of within our sphere of egocentric thought and of our experience. And so if we do witness, let's say, a partner, let's say, having difficulty with erection, it would make sense that some folks will say, it must be because they're not attracted to me anymore, or they must not be happy, or I may be doing something wrong. It may be my fault. And I think that is something that you will see present. And sometimes it's not. You know, I think we have to normalize the idea that sometimes individual factors can happen to the individual and it affects the relationship, but it's not necessarily it's not being caused by their partner. Now, I do believe that there is something called the interaction effect, where we start interacting and feeding off of each other's experience that also creates maladaptive or even dysfunctional sort of patterns in relationships. That if one person experiences an erection difficulty and their partner feels really bad about it, thinks it's their fault, and then they pull away, then that person also is now creating distance in the relationship. Or maybe that person starts to yell or gets angry and starts expressing themselves, and that creates maybe conflict. So there can be ways that we all contribute to our relationship, which I think makes it complex. You know, these issues are not there's a lot of complexities and a lot of layers to sexual concerns. That sex to me is one of the most vulnerable and delicate areas when it comes to our psyche and our relationships. So therefore, it's going to have a lot of layers for us to have to unpack and deconstruct for us to be able to truly become aware and to work towards maybe some of those, that healing that I think a lot of us are leaning towards.
Yes. And so it does then depend on how, let's put it this way, how diversified the male ego portfolio is. I got to meet Dr. William Masters. By then he was about 77. He said, Dr. William Masters, of course, for the listening audience, many know this, but Masters and Johnson did research in the 50s and 60s that pretty much formed the sex therapy field, especially Virginia Johnson and all of her exercises with Sensate Focus and so on. But Dr. William Masters, he was asked, what is the best advice that he could give to an older man who is worried that he's losing his potency? And he said, talk to your partner. Tell her you have these concerns. She's probably concerned and afraid to tell you. And then talk to a competent sexologist about how to reactivate your bedroom scene. And he had a very humble definition of good communication, Dr. Masters did, in a relationship. And he said, it's the privilege of exchanging vulnerabilities. And you used the word vulnerable earlier in our discussion. The privilege of peeling back that onion, really getting to the core, exchanging vulnerabilities. We've got a partnership here, a team, and the man and the woman have to be totally honest and talk about what's going on. And, of course, that's why seeing a sex therapist can really help. Because sometimes they can't get that kind of a conversation started.
Well, I think we've never been taught. I mean, how many of us have been taught to be in relationships? You know, we never had a class. We never had a lot of nurturance or socialization that encouraged us to be vulnerable. If anything, I think we have, you know, when you look at men and women growing up, the nurturance models are very different. I think that you don't have a lot of emotional intelligence and vulnerability emphasis for young boys growing up, whereas you may have a bit more of that for girls. So we're already socializing ourselves to focus on different sort of areas within relationships. And I think we need a lot more of a socialization that encourages us to be vulnerable. I love what that quote you just mentioned about Bill Masters, because, mm-hmm. you know, vulnerability, if you can get comfortable with that, you can have the freedom to be able to share and express without too much anxiety, and you'll find that it's liberating. You know, a moment ago I shared that I have had erection difficulties, let's say if I drank too much, and that's a vulnerable mm-hmm. expression that I was very comfortable expressing, that I'll tell my students, I'll tell a client, I'll share on a radio show, because I've gotten secure and comfortable enough with my humanness, you know, my humanity.
Yes.
But what happens
and
if
I
do that?
I really thank you for sharing that, and of course, you're still a young man, and that's fairly common for young men and older men too, of course. Mm-hmm. But alcohol, it can ruin erections. Too much alcohol. It's because it's a central nervous system depressant.
Sure.
And
sure.
And so it dampens sexual arousal, and that's particularly true for older men, but it also can affect younger men too. So
here's another thing that comes up with erection difficulties and even just sexual sort of distance and frustration. When a partner, either partner, any partner, has difficulty expressing what they truly want and desire. Like many people have an incongruency with their fantasy life that they fantasize about and they masturbate to, and their sex life with partners. And I think we have to start looking at the incongruency. That if I have deeper desires that are incredibly arousing and I'm not sharing those with the person or the partner that I'm with or the partners that I'm with, am I doing myself a disservice in terms of inviting pleasure into my life by inhibiting the opportunity for me to experience these things? And can I find the vulnerability and the empowerment and the courage to share that? Because a lot of folks are the anxiety or the fear of judgment or the worries and insecurities that come up that inhibit us from facing and bringing these things into their experiences. And I've had so many fetishist clients. I've had so many people who had, you know, sort of sexual desires that are a little bit outside the box of the mainstream, but they're still completely acceptable and completely sort of normative, have shared that. And the amount of freedom that has opened up in their relationship when they have a partner who's comfortable to accept, to embrace it, to invite it into the bedroom, it can be revolutionary and relationship altering, really.
Again, you express it so eloquently. That's excellent. The incongruency. And you are clearly a really good sex therapist. And we're not through with the show yet, but Hernando, I really want you back on this show, because you're giving very, very good advice, and you're expressing the situations so well. You know, I think that for the majority of men, penis power is like 99% between the ears and 1% between the legs, really. Mm-hmm. The power of positive thinking is what counts. And just to kind of summarize, I think women should learn all they can about how, where, why, and when the penis in your life works, and the guy that you're having a relationship with, and you know, if there's that kind of communication between good communication, clear communication, mm-hmm. vulnerable communication, then I think the lives will be enriched in more ways than you can ever imagine. And, once we that you can feel. I mean, haven't you witnessed transformations in sex lives of couples you've worked with?
You know, I've been so fortunate and blessed to be a part of people's healing and people creating awareness and making changes in their lives to improve their sex life and their relationship life. And sometimes they can be, related to trauma and profound sort of experiences they've had in their past that have been difficult for them to face and relationships to work towards healing. And sometimes they've also been, maybe even we will call maybe lighter or surface-oriented changes that have been so profound in shaping the change in their relationship. I had a couple that, I encourage them to ask each other questions and communicate more, just like you were alluding to earlier, Dr. Diana. And I encourage them to ask questions about what is stressing them each other out, what kind of anxiety are they experiencing. And it would change. Obviously, we all have shifts and changes that happen day to day and week to week. And sometimes you'd have a partner saying, I'm just really stressed out right now with the childcare or with, the house not being so clean. And that really does stay in my mind that affects me, sexually and affects me some feeling that freedom. And so you'll have the other partner learn that. And then the other partner might take it upon themselves to clean up the house. And you may think, well, cleaning up the house, how's that going to help your sex life? It's going to help your partner's anxiety, and it may make them feel more relaxed. And you may, or they may say, I have really tense muscles, and maybe they ask for a massage and express their needs. And so you give them a massage, and that opens them up to feeling more relaxed and maybe more sexual. I just think that the more we have conversations around understanding each other and listening and creating space for us to express ourselves and to really hear it, I think you'll find that our partners will be sharing sort of breadcrumbs to helping us formulate either less anxiety, more of a healthy relationship, and maybe opening the door for us to experience, sex without a lot of that mental, baggage that we sometimes carry within.
You mentioned listening, and I think that some of the best sexual advice is to really listen to your partner. And, taking turns with a talking stick. It's one of the exercises in my book, Love in the Time of Corona, mm-hmm. where the person who has the talking stick, the pen, say, gets 1 or 2 minutes, and then the other person has to say back what they heard the first person saying. And if that was correct, then the other person gets to have his or her mm-hmm. time using the talking stick. So there mm-hmm. are lots of ways, of course, to improve communication. You and I we didn't really get into too much into erectile dysfunction, and I think the next time I have you back, and we'll talk off the air about when that'll be, you'll come back, won't you?
Absolutely. Thank you.
Yeah, great. Great. Because we really want to banish stress from the bedroom and make sex fun again, I think it's never too late to change your sexual story if a person takes charge of it and uses the facts to create something that you like instead of a story that leaves you feeling incompetent or incomplete. And a person should remember that it's your story, so let's make it a happier story and a more fulfilling story. And again, that's why I'm so pleased that Progressive Radio Network has allowed me to be on their station for, as I said at the top of the show, for 11 years now. We need to get out more solid, good information. And Dr. Hernando, you've helped with this so much today. So there's the music. Thank you again, Dr. Hernando.
I appreciate you having me on. Thank you, Dr. Diana. Thank you.
We'll talk more later, everybody. Take care. Have fun. Slow down. Thanks again, Dr. Hernando. Bye-bye, everybody.